From the 89.1 WBOI studios in Fort Wayne, Indiana, welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer and host of this program, and thank you for joining me. In 2020, George Floyd's death occurred on Memorial Day. We are going to focus on issues of racial justice for this week's show as we hear a virtual talk recorded as part of the Values, Ideas, and the Arts series at Manchester University. Words and Actions, a presentation by David Luke, Interim Diversity Officer and Director at University of Michigan Flint. Stay close. Last year after the death of George Floyd, and protests right here in Northeast Indiana, we aired a program from Manchester University's Values, Ideas, and the Arts series. At the time, this was a rebroadcast of a presentation we'd aired previously, featuring David Pilgrim, founder and director of the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia. One year later, we will again hear from the same series, and a speaker from a college in Michigan. David Luke has a PhD in sociology, and will share about how systemic racism and sociology inform his approach to diversity, equity, and inclusion work. He spoke for a virtual event at Manchester University on March 9th. Please enjoy the show.
Good evening. I want to thank you all for coming. I want to especially thank Professor Friesen and the VIA committee for including me in this Values, Ideas, and Arts series. I think my remarks will fit well with some of the others this semester and are timely given what we've seen over the last year. This title speaks to the importance of understanding the terminology we use, and from that understanding, taking appropriate action. Some of the words we'll be discussing include systemic racism and understanding what that is, diversity, equity, and inclusion, words that we need to understand in order to properly address. So who am I? And Jared gave a little bit of an introduction. And I will say, you know, the accounting degree was the result of the pressure of going to school and you should graduate and get a good job. And I did that for a little while and I learned that it wasn't a good fit for me. And so I was able to return to school to study sociology. But so I'm here as a trained sociologist, as a multiracial person, the son of an immigrant father who is an Indian man from Malaysia and a white American mother. I've always had interest in race from a young age. An interest in race and higher education since I was a student at Grand Valley State. Interest in race continued in my time in corporate America as an accountant and a person of color, and evolved during my time at the University of Kentucky when I studied sociology and worked in their Office for Institutional Diversity. I currently serve as the Interim Campus Diversity Officer and Director of the Intercultural Center at the University of Michigan Flint. For someone like me, whose race is ambiguous to many people at first glance, I'm often confronted with what I realize in my interactions with others are unique racial situations that have helped cultivate my curiosity to understand race more, and I believe helped me to empathize with people of different identities. So a brief overview, I want to chat for a while, and then I want to give some time if people have questions that we can talk a little bit more informally as well. Talk about systemic racism, talk about how that has looked in the U.S., talk about the idea of an HWCU, and then sort of wrap up. So I'm issuing this warning. We are going to talk about systemic racism. And I realize there are varying levels of comfort with these types of conversations. I often have these types of conversations. So I want to be conscious of that other people might be a little bit less comfortable with that, and that's okay. Research has shown that in the U.S., white parents talk to their children about race on average at about age 13. And for Black parents, the average age in which they begin to talk to their kids about race is at 3 years old. So there's a very differing level of comfort in having these conversations about race and racism. And as Jared mentioned, I am a sociologist, which informs how I talk and think about race and racism. So you'll see that our focus is going to be less about individual belief and psychology and more focused on policies and practices that remedy racial inequity. Further, systemic racism is one form of systemic oppression, but we know there are many others that we need to understand and be aware of as well. And I have to start with, one of the learning outcomes that is most common in intro to sociology classes is that we want students to understand what the sociological imagination is. And so as a starting point, the sociological imagination very basically is understanding private troubles as public issues. So C. Wright Mills says it's the vivid awareness of the relationship between experience and the wider society. And there is this underlying tension in sociology between structure and agency. So we have agency to make choices, but it's within these other structures. So as Karl Marx said, men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. And the evidence that we have about systemic racism is rampant. But what you find often is in the media and in common political discourse, more individualized explanations of racial phenomena. But I saw a change recently that brought some optimism. So what you're looking at in this graph, the columns on the right here are showing that a poll that was done after the police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And at that time, the majority of respondents to this poll believed that the killing of Michael Brown was an isolated incident. Now, more recently, after the police killing of George Floyd, the same sort of poll was taken, and the vast majority of respondents saw the killing of George Floyd as signifying a broader problem. So what I see here is a recognition, a use of the sociological imagination by a larger proportion of the public, understanding the George Floyd murder as a part of a larger pattern. This recognition of systemic racism in the U.S. criminal justice system, and many people have been talking about systemic racism more publicly, but I think we need to talk about what that actually means. So I'm encouraged by this, and I do want to point out that I think it is largely white Americans that came to a new realization that this was a sign of a broader problem. Among communities of color, largely people were looking at their own instances and encounters with law enforcement and seeing a pattern and understanding those things as a pattern. So what is systemic racism? There is significant public discussion around systemic racism lately and protests against it. Importantly for many white Americans now, awakened to and outraged by systemic racism, this is their first significant engagement with the idea. So let's not water it down at all. Sociologist Joe Fagan, pictured here, is largely credited with having coined the term systemic racism, having developed it in his book, Systemic Racism, A Theory of Oppression. He introduces the concept in his book, Racist America, Roots, Current Realities, and Future Reparations. The book begins in the first chapter by discussing the 1787 Constitutional Convention, where 55 white men in the top 2% of wealth, 40% of whom owned slaves, began developing the U.S. founding documents and deliberately excluded 20% of the population at the time who were enslaved, as well as indigenous people. Women, significantly, were also excluded from this convention, so another half of the population. That's systemic racism. From Fagan's perspective, the U.S. was built on it. He explains systemic racism involves both the deep structures and the surface structures of racial oppression. It includes the complex array of anti-Black practices, the unjustly gained political economic power of whites, the continuing economic and other resource inequalities along racial lines, and the emotion-laden racist framing created by whites to maintain and rationalize their privilege and power. Systemic racism thus encompasses the white racist attitudes, ideologies, images, actions, and institutions of this society. This racism is a material, social, and ideological reality, and is indeed systemic, which means the racist reality is manifested in all major institutions. Each major part of U.S. society, the economy, politics, education, religion, the family, reflect the fundamental realities of systemic racism. So the U.S. and many of its institutions were built fundamentally on a system of racism and exploitation. Genocide and slavery were two critical components to the building of the U.S. As such, efforts to fight systemic racism challenge many of our core institutions and their practices, implicit ideologies, etc. Because racism was built in, eliminating systemic racism will take some deconstruction and rebuilding. And I think it's bigger work than many people realize, and that's why it's important to understand the terms that we use. Fagan has a suggestion, which is the need for a new constitutional convention based on the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights and related documents. As a country built on, with, and through systemic racism, he argues for a new foundation, a new starting point, and a new reality. This type of transformative change that people are advocating for when they talk about fighting systemic racism, but I don't think that most people who use that term realize that's what they're saying. Understanding systemic racism is an effort to honestly understand our history, knowing that the writers of history will frame things in ways favorable to them. So I have this African proverb displayed on the screen: until lions have their own historians, tales of the hunt will always glorify the hunters. I was taught in school, in a predominantly white parochial school, that the Civil War was fundamentally about states' rights and not slavery, when in fact I found it was about states' rights to own slaves. And so who tells our history is important. There's a group, the United Daughters of the Confederacy. This group was largely responsible for erecting Confederate monuments in the early 20th century, in the 1920s and 30s. This same group, the United Daughters of the Confederacy, were largely responsible for writing public school history textbooks. So I'm going to begin by providing some evidence of the existence and persistence of systemic racism in the U.S., because unfortunately, most of the conversations about racism begin with verifying that it's real. This hampers our ability to move the conversation forward. Nonetheless, we need a shared basis for understanding systemic racism in the U.S. to then think of its implications in higher education. So let's look back historically. In terms of employment, in 1890, 87% of African Americans worked as agricultural or domestic workers. These occupations were excluded from the Social Security Act of 1935. So importantly, occupations were excluded. So there was nothing racial in the writing of this act, but the effect was to exclude 87% of Black workers. In politics, in the 1920s, full citizenship was available to a free white person in the U.S. And it wasn't until 1965 that a quota system based on national origins was eliminated from U.S. immigration policy. It is interesting, the criteria of free white person led to a number of court cases in which people of color were petitioning for citizenship and trying to make the case that they were white. So two famous cases that occurred within the same calendar year. One was a Japanese-American man named Ozawa, who lived in the U.S. and had a family there and built a life there. And he wanted to petition for citizenship. So when it got to proving that he was a free white person, he looked at his complexion and he said, you know, my skin is fair. It's essentially white. I should be white. The judge at the time said, no, based on the anthropological classifications we're using, you wouldn't be a Caucasoid, you are a Mongoloid. And so, no, you're not a citizen. So fast forward a few months, an Indian man named Thind, knowing that Indians were considered Caucasoids, thought, okay, well, I can get citizenship then. Petitions for it, says, you know, we're Caucasoid. And the judge essentially says, well, everybody knows Indians aren't white. And so that category of whiteness has shifted and changed based on political interests. And then African Americans were not given the right to vote until 1965, which is not very long ago. In terms of housing, redlining was a method formalized by the federal government and implemented by banks to create racial residential segregation and was common practice until the Fair Housing Act of 1968, which is not that long ago also. It's important to note that that was part of the creation of residential segregation, that that was something that was produced. And that practice had a substantial impact on the racial wealth gap. When you think of most middle-class families, their largest investment is typically their home. And so if you are prohibited from buying a home in an area where the home values are going to rise significantly, you are prohibited from growing your wealth in that way. In terms of education, the setup of public school funding on the basis of property taxes means poorer schools have fewer educational resources and offer lower quality because people of color are disproportionately overrepresented among the poor. The impact is racialized. There's also a history of racial and occupational tracking in schools. And here are citations so that you know I'm not just making stuff up. Historically, some more. In terms of wealth and income, slavery and sharecropping in the South, exclusion from unions in the North, during industrialization, and factors like redlining have all impacted the large wealth disparity. In terms of health, From 1932 to 1972, the Tuskegee Syphilis Study conducted by the U.S. Public Health Service diagnosed and left untreated syphilis in hundreds of African-American men, even though the research subjects were told that they were being treated for, quote, bad blood. This history contributes to feelings of mistrust among some people of color for the healthcare system. Criminal justice. The roots of modern policing trace back to slave patrols and night watches designed to control the behavior of people of color and protect the property of the wealthy. So when we think about systemic racism in the criminal justice system, this is some of the roots. Black civil rights leaders in history were targeted by the FBI through their counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, including the now esteemed Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was considered the most dangerous man in the country. Pictured here, and I'll move on and you'll be able to see a bit more of this, but pictured here is a letter from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover asking Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to kill himself. A snippet from the letter. King, there is only one thing left for you to do. You know what it is. You are done. There is but one way out for you. You better take it before your filthy, abnormal, fraudulent self is bared to the nation. So the FBI was sending this threatening letter asking someone who now has a national holiday named after them to kill himself. But that's all old stuff. So systemic racism, part of what's problematic about it is that it's built in. Right. So systemic racism persists in spite of some of the progress that has been made. In employment, in a 2004 study, researchers submitted resumes for job ads with only the names of the applicants varied between stereotypically Black and stereotypically white sounding names. For a Black applicant with 8 years of experience was called back at the same rate as a white applicant with no experience. A similar study in 2007 that included criminal justice status and race showed that white applicants with a criminal record were more likely to be called back for a job than Black applicants with a clean record. In politics, there are a total of 10 people of color in the U.S. Senate out of 100, many of whom do not well represent the views of the majority of people of color in the country. Additionally, gerrymandering and similar practices distribute and weaken voting power of people of color in the way that districts are drawn. In housing, the Department of Housing and Urban Development in its 2012 housing discrimination study found that Blacks and Latinos experienced discrimination in roughly half of their efforts to rent or buy and are denied available housing from 35 to 75% of the time based on housing audits done in various cities. In education, despite some progress immediately after the Civil Rights Act's passage, schools were more segregated in 2000-2001 than in 1970, with profound inequality between schools in wealth and income. According to the Federal Reserve Survey of Consumer Finances in 2013, the median white family had as much as 13 times as much net wealth, so about $142,000, as the median Black family that had $11,000, and 10 times as much as the median Latino family that had about $14,000. Note that Asians and other groups are not separately identified in the public use data for this survey. In terms of health, for 10 of the leading 15 causes of death, African Americans have higher rates compared to whites. Infant mortality rates for African Americans is more than twice that of white infants, and the life expectancy for Black people is about 4 years shorter than whites. In terms of criminal justice, African Americans are 4.3 times as likely to receive the death sentence. They receive 49% longer sentences than whites for the same crimes. And this one is important, I think. Black people are 14% of illegal drug users. So what research indicates that people use drugs, people of all races use drugs at about the same rates. So 14% is close to the Black population in the U.S., but they're 35% of arrests, 55% of convictions, and 74% of incarcerations. Note that in a fair system, you would expect to see the number be 14% at each stage, right? Because 14% of users should be 14% of arrests, should be 14% of convictions, and should be 14% of incarcerations. So that it increases at every step is indicative of some of the problems. All right, so I want to look a little bit now at U.S. higher education. You all are affiliated with Manchester University. Jared talked about we were at the University of Kentucky together. I've been to Grand Valley State. I'm working at U of M Flint. So people know a little bit about universities here. Higher education scholars often use this term, predominantly white institution. And other terms are used like historically Black college or university for some schools, right? Like a number of other scholars, I prefer to use the term historically white college or university instead of predominantly white institution, as I think it better evidences the parallel history and the intentionality with which schools like the University of Kentucky, the University of Michigan Flint, and Manchester University were designed. White, middle, and upper middle class, primarily male students, were often the ideal student population. So often these institutions still default to centering that population, centering whiteness and white students and faculty and staff in their operations. Eduardo Bonilla Silva, who is a former president of the American Sociological Association and a professor at Duke University, says this: "The racial character of historically black colleges and universities is tattooed in their very name. These colleges are seen as all black institutions with a black agenda. For HWCUs, however, we never ponder about the whiteness of these places. We rarely question the history and practices that create and maintain these institutions as white. Instead, we conceive of them in universalistic terms as just colleges and universities. These colleges, however, have a history, demography, curriculum, climate, and symbols and traditions that embody and signify and reproduce whiteness. For example, most traditions in HWCUs predate their so-called integration and thus are exclusionary, such as homecoming. Racial incidents also abound in homecoming weekends and in so-called integrated campuses." As a side note here, while Professor Friesen and I were at the University of Kentucky, which had been integrated since the 1950s, and so this was in the 2010s, there was the first Black homecoming king and queen at the university, right? To the point of, you know, these traditions predated integration, and it took another 60 some years for there to be a Black homecoming king and queen. Bonilla Silva goes on: "The demography and symbols in HWCUs create an oppressive racial ecology where just walking on campus is unhealthy, where minority students and faculty feel, as one observer commented, as guests who have no history in the house they occupy. There are no photographs on the wall that reflect their image. Their paraphernalia, paintings, scents, and sounds do not appear in the house." He goes on to discuss how the climate often bleeds into the towns and local businesses, and how people with often terrible, problematic backgrounds like Christopher Columbus are routinely celebrated on these campuses. So that's Eduardo Bonilla Silva there. And so I say, you know, what do historically white colleges and universities do well? What they do relatively well is enroll, retain, and graduate white students. And the point I'm making is because they were designed to do that, right? So while we'll focus on race, HWCUs often center heterosexual, cisgender, able-bodied white men who hold a number of dominant social identities, and those populations generally thrive relative to others. I work in an intercultural center. I worked at the Martin Luther King Center at the University of Kentucky. These types of centers came about in response to student activism, primarily of students of color, saying we need a space on this campus because it is that hostile climate that Bonilla Silva described. We see women's centers on campuses like this. We see LGBT centers. All of these types of centers are sort of, in my mind, recognitions that we need to better serve this student population. And it's unsurprising that we need to better serve a student population that we weren't intending to serve in the first place. So if we look at public universities and their six-year graduation rates by race, what we find is consistent disparities. So this is the overall averages, and these racial disparities are indicative of the racial character of HWCUs and what they do relatively well. I would say graduating 64% of white students in 6 years isn't really great, but it is good relative to the rates for Black and Latino students. So I've listed here language of diversity. And so this sort of loosely follows an institution, but it also is common at several. If we look at the history of some of what are now like institutional diversity offices or offices of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and trace them back, often they started out as offices of minority student affairs or something like that, and then sort of shift to multicultural affairs, shift then to institutional diversity, and then maybe, you know, maybe we're going towards something about inclusive excellence or something. Now, think about the specificity of these terms and what direction we're moving. In this example, what was once the Office of Minority Student Affairs transitioned to multicultural affairs, to institutional diversity or diversity, equity, and inclusion. And then I speculate maybe something about inclusive excellence is coming. Some have noted that diversity is often framed in terms of culture, religion, experience, or other non-racial factors, going so far as to consider pet ownership as a form of diversity. This makes conversations about racial inequality and civil rights very difficult. That language of diversity doesn't really allow for conversations about inequity. When I was applying for jobs in an accounting firm, I asked the firms what they had in terms of diversity sort of programs. And one of them said, well, people can come in anytime between 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. We offer flex scheduling in that way because we know some people are morning people and some people are night people. Now, I guess technically that is different types of people, but that certainly is not getting at any sort of structural inequities in that firm. Others have observed that diversity hinders investigations into deeper structural inequities in organizations and that it is increasingly rationalized by economic means exclusively. So pursue diversity because it's profitable. Diverse teams make better decisions, and that'll be financially beneficial. Or diversity, supporting diverse students means you'll retain them at higher rates, means more tuition revenue for an institution, right? Ellen Berry's book, The Enigma of Diversity, which is pictured here, documents how this process works. Initiatives often begin as race conscious and rooted in redistributive justice, but over time have shifted to softer programs oriented around diversity. Berry notes how diversity discourse can be used to silence real questions about social justice, giving one memorable example where at a public forum at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, a student questioned the usefulness of the word and concept of diversity to describe the negative experience she had faced as a person of color on that campus. The response from administrators at the time was to explain that this student's freedom and ability to make this complaint is evidence of the university's support for diversity. This was just one example of how the language of diversity stifles social justice. Diversity language is problematic. Now, we have to consider with engaging in this work, that we're also under political constraints. So in Michigan, I'm under different political constraints than I was in Kentucky. Michigan is a state that has a ban on affirmative action, and so I can't do any sort of programming that is specific to a certain group. I can center certain identities, but everyone is welcome in every program. Whereas at the University of Kentucky, they are under being monitored by the U.S. Department of Education and have to submit annual reports to the Kentucky Council on Postsecondary Education that set goals for how they will increase the retention rates for students of color. And this is sort of a result of them being a southern state. But what we've seen nationally is a shift in the political environment, a shift towards enforcement of anti-discrimination policies to protect white students. Unclear if that's going to continue, but that was something that was happening more and that federal enforcement agencies were being instructed to do under the previous presidential administration. And there was also an executive order, which has now been reversed, that banned diversity training and for federal contractors. State politics matter too. I mentioned affirmative action bans in some states. Tennessee was defunding the diversity initiatives in their universities. We've seen a decline over time of state support for public education and state appropriations. And we witness accusations of liberal indoctrination at universities, which impacts, I think, the way that we can engage in discourse. And I think the idea of inertia is helpful here. So that's the idea that objects at rest tend to remain at rest, and objects in motion tend to remain in motion at the same line unless affected by some other force. These institutions, historically white colleges and universities, have been largely at rest with regard to initiatives for people of color since their inception, and in a motion that benefited white male students. We are the other force. We are pushing institutions from their rest or steering them when they're in motion and acting against that inertia, and that's difficult. So in order for us to successfully combat systemic racism, forms of systemic oppression on campuses, we need all hands on deck. People that understand this at every level of the institution to make thorough, meaningful change, because we're trying to fundamentally shift the institution. While that's a long and arduous process, we need to be mindful that better is good and take note of progress along the way. And I think this is a really important point. This work, diversity, equity, and inclusion work, we're shackled by the language somewhat, right? But if we're thinking about what systemic racism is and we're thinking about oppression in that systemic way, this is going to be some fundamental change. And this will require collective effort for people at these institutions. So I want to give some concluding thoughts. And in the past, I've done this talk and made some comparisons between historically white colleges and universities and a really unique school, which is Berea College in Kentucky, which was the first interracial co-ed college in the state and has been interracial since before the Civil War in the South. So HWC reform must be from top to bottom. In the same way that Joe Fagan suggests a new constitutional convention, we need to sort of examine everything about the way these institutions operate. I'll refer to Ibram X. Kendi's now very popular book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, where he makes a number of he sets things up in binary, which doesn't always work, but it is useful for thinking about combating systemic oppression. So he says, there's no such thing as being not racist. Things are racist or anti-racist. And so if you think about racism systemically, things being either racist is just the status quo operation of society. And anti-racism is making that radical change. And just letting things be how they are as being complicit in racism in that way. So HWCU reform needs to be from top to bottom. The mission, vision, and values should reflect if DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion are institutional priorities. And specificity matters. We can talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, but sometimes that doesn't do enough. We need to clearly define those terms. And there needs to be an institutional commitment to decenter whiteness. I had an experience at an institution where working in a center that was focused on serving students of color, and there was a major push for that center to talk about how they were serving white students. And the pushback that I would like to give was that most of that campus was focused on serving white students and that we were underserving our students of color, as reflected by how they perceived the climate and by their success and retention at the institution. And so we needed that commitment to decenter whiteness. HWC reform must not be sincere. Efforts must be sincere. Efforts cannot be for PR. They're very obvious when they are. You know, I think what we saw in June, July, August, we saw corporations that had no interest in racial justice putting Black Lives Matter on their products in an effort to sell products, right? That's the kind of PR stuff. So most universities issued some sort of statements in late May, early June, their leadership did. And a statement is something, and that's words, but then we need to see the action behind it. And the action needs to be meaningful and needs to be strong. There are a ton of different rationales that can be effective, easy ways to justify the importance of HWCU reform. And so I think about, I made the comment that you can justify diversity in economic means and that's increasingly done. And that's not my preferred thing, but for me, my focus is on the outcome. So if Professor Friesen, as an example, and I know this is not true, but if he was not morally drawn to equity and justice, and I could make a financial case that would get him on board, and he's a decision maker and an influential person, I will do that because I think I'm focused on the goal. And, you know, maybe ultimately he'll come around to the moral case for it. I don't know. HWCU reform will take time, and that's not an excuse. But we are working against years of complicity with racism. And so I reference Ibram X. Kendi there. This type of reform is long-term, but in the meantime, there are ways to respond to efforts to center whiteness. So provide rationale for centering marginalized students, a retention rate and graduation rate gaps, explaining what an HWCU is and how whiteness goes unnamed. I would say oftentimes we find that dominant categories go unnamed, and that's part of where their power is driven from. So when I married my wife, we had a wedding. And when my buddy married his husband, they had a gay wedding, right? We name the thing that is not the sort of dominant category. And I think in naming that, it draws attention to it, it others it in ways. And then we take for granted that that is a very heteronormative thing to just refer to a wedding as a wedding and to not to have to specify for a same-sex marriage. Providing services that center white students, that focus on understanding and deconstructing whiteness and white identity, is a way to do this work at HWCU. So then you can generate allies for a powerful multiracial campus coalition to advance reform. And you can use benchmarking and study what's being done at HBCUs or at schools like Berea, which there aren't very many, for inspiration for how to cultivate a stronger sense of belonging for students of color. HWCUs have needs too. They need more faculty, staff, and administrators of color, and they need more white allies to stand up and be identified as such. They need earnest commitments to disrupting the status quo that continue to underserve minoritized populations. They need continuous critical evaluation of who holds power, who is advantaged by each decision. And they need to go further than this happy talk of diversity and inclusion and make real substantive change to compensate for the continuous impact of centering whiteness in the past and in the present. I make a joke sometimes that, in sociology, if you look at curriculum across the country, you will see social problems as courses that there will be a course in social problems in most sociology programs, and there's not one in social solutions. So at the end there, I attempted to give some sorts of thoughts for what we can do next, but I also recognize, this could be a little bit of a downer in some ways, but I want to thank you all for the invitation to engage, and I'm happy to take questions.
All right, so I have sent a message out on the chat on Zoom and also on the Facebook Live feed to anyone who has any questions. So you can either talk or you could write it in the chat, and then Dr. Luke can take your questions or comments, things that you want to say.
This is Alicia Daly. First, I want to thank you, Dr. Luke. I'm the one and only domestic African-American faculty here from both campuses, in North Manchester and Fort Wayne campuses, over 100 faculty. This is my fourth year. And one of the things that I struggle with on a day-to-day basis is weighing the consequences of speaking up and having pushback and being silent and burning up on the inside. I guess, and so that's an ongoing issue for me. It's difficult. And one thing that's happened, I'll try to be vague so that no one can trace it to anyone in particular, would be when more attention is given to minoritized populations, then I think what you were talking about, then whites start saying, well, why wasn't I at the table? Why wasn't I, consulted? And that's just difficult. I don't know if you have any words of wisdom when you're trying to navigate this.
Yeah, I think you're right that is difficult. And I think that's something about the nature of historically white colleges and universities, is that because they have historically been white centering, that when you do things that don't center whiteness, it's quite alarming to people. And I think, in some ways, helping folks process that, would be useful. I think about, I remember times when I worked at Kentucky, and the center was the Martin Luther King Center, and I would have white students walk up to the doorway, and it was as if there was an invisible wall that they wouldn't step their feet in the space. And I, at one point I said, how do you think your colleagues who are in here feel walking into the classroom? Right. If they go into a classroom and all the other students are white, they don't get to just stand by the door and be like, I don't know if I want to go in there. Right. Because they don't have that choice. And so I think we have to recognize some of that discomfort. I mean, there are ways that I also hold privilege that I can engage in some productive discomfort by putting myself in different situations. And I think we need to help with that. I think one of the things for you is, to the extent that you can, find some white allies that you can really connect with and talk to, and that will be supportive of you, and that might speak up for you when you're too tired, or might notice, because I know how that is, and in the positions I've been in, it's typically part of my job to do some of that speaking up, but how you do that can be really challenging and really exhausting. But so, whenever you can get somebody sort of surprises you, and they speak up and mention it for you, or call it out and you don't have to, that's a real positive. But it's hard. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We have an upcoming project about racism, diversity, and inclusion at Manchester. What are some questions you think we should ask to make Manchester a more diverse and inclusive place? I'd be curious the nature of the project. I mean, I think I don't know if the institution has done any sort of climate survey in the recent past. Most institutions do those from time to time at some points, but you could probably look at that and get a sense for some of the issues that people are facing. I'll say that, you know, when I came to U of M Flint, and this is not uncommon things, students complained about microaggressions in the classroom. For example, a Black student being asked to speak on behalf of Black people, which we, if you think about that, is quite absurd for them to somehow know what the vast, diverse majority of Black people know. Or making comments that are sort of allude to stereotypes or sort of, and so those were sometimes happen that faculty would perpetrate those, and sometimes they would be by other students. In the times where faculty were the ones who did the microaggressions, you know, that's one thing. But when a student does and a faculty member doesn't step up and address it, that's also another source of frustration and hurt and harm for people. And, you know, I referenced the graduation rates and retention rates. That data is publicly available. And so you can look at those. And I think when you see gaps there, those are indicative of something happening. To the extent that they have information on why students are leaving, you know, that's worth looking into. It sounds like you're trying to maybe make a survey or something, though. Is that what the project is?
Our project, we're basically going to send out a survey to Manchester students and just have them answer questions about, you know, diversity and inclusion.
Yeah, I would think about if there have been past climate studies, or if you Google like climate survey, racial climate survey or something, you might get ideas for some of the sorts of questions that people might ask. But, you know, some of the things might address, you know, what has your experience been in the classroom? How have you felt that you belong here? You know, get at sort of that sense of belonging. I think those are sort of the types of questions you want to see in that sort of project, how people are experiencing the university and how that might vary based on their identities, right? And that's how you sort of get at some of the problems of inclusion.
One thing I was kind of wondering about was, so kind of thinking about, like, we have moments, like if I ask students of color if they've ever heard not just microaggressions, but, you know, like the N-word said on campus or things like that, it's really, I would say anecdotally, pretty common for them to say, yes, I have heard that. And, you know, I mean, to me, that actually was sort of, I was naively shocked by that when I first heard that, just because I thought, that's too blatant, you know, that's too over the top, but apparently it's not. And I guess I'm wondering, and maybe that, again, I'm just thinking out loud here, but, you know, what have you ever heard of any school develop sort of almost similar to a report it type thing that Title IX would have about issues of, or, you know, problems related to, you know, racism, xenophobia, things like that? Or is that really not the way that things should go?
Well, that's a good question. So when we were at UK, I'll say this, that I would hear a student come and say, oh, this pickup truck drove past and they yelled the N-word. And there's four other students in there and they're all like, oh, that happened to me last week. Oh, that happened. And so they're just kind of like, well, I guess that's what happens here, right? And that was, I think, the hardest thing for me, because we want students to report things. So we would say, you know, do our bias incident reporting process or whatever. And first off, you know, okay, maybe they'll consider reporting it, but they just heard from everybody else that it happened to them. So, you know, what's the use? And what sort of teeth do those processes and those teams have? And I think one of the issues is that when you think of Title IX and some of the sexual harassment stuff, a lot of that is mandated from the federal government. And if we don't have a comparable mandate, institutions seem reluctant to be that punitive for things. So I think I would like, I'm with you that I think I would like to see some swift sort of action. I think there also needs to be, so when I was worked at the accounting firm, wasn't racial slurs, but I had coworkers that would know that they couldn't say certain things because the social ramifications of them saying it would be bad. Oh, if I say that, then people will think I'm racist and that'll be so terrible. And I felt, you know, in the last 5 years that some people, there were some prominent figures that were not paying attention to political correctness or pushing back against political correctness. And they said, well, I'm going to say what I want to say. And that people like my old colleague would think, yeah, I should say what I want to say because I don't understand fundamentally why I shouldn't have said that anyways. The reason why I wasn't saying it was because I was afraid bad things would happen to me. So I think there should be some punishment. And I think there needs to be some sort of education as to the gravity of some of these words, the history and the violence behind them, so that people won't try to take them lightly in that way. And someone commented, Alicia commented in the chat, Jared, the report it button applies to racial bias, not just Title IX. So for students, please use the report it button and there's follow-up in that.
Other thoughts or questions? So one of the things that I don't know where this fits into the conversation, but another thing that gets brought up a lot for our institution is that, so we have two campuses and one is in Fort Wayne, which is a relatively large city, you know, maybe it's slightly smaller than Grand Rapids or something like that. And then the other one, which is the one that the undergraduate students are on almost exclusively, is in a pretty small town, and it's pretty white. You know, kind of the things that you might think of when you picture rural Midwest. And so this is kind of this thing that I feel like gets brought out as sort of a white flag about diversity, equity and inclusion issues that, well, what can we do? We're it's our location. On the other hand, it is our location. And, you know, if I had, you know, a friend that I happen to know that, you know, I do know people that have been qualified for jobs and I've let them know and they've responded to me, thanks for letting me know. I don't think that's going to work for me, you know? You know, because I guess I'm thinking about, you know, part of, I think in my mind, decentering whiteness would be, you know, to not have every person that works, not every, but to have more proportionate, faculty and staff.
Yeah.
In terms of race and ethnicity.
Yeah, that would make a big difference. And you have the challenge of, you know, I met your one African-American faculty member on both campuses just now, right? So there are very small numbers. You know, to the extent that it's financially feasible, cluster hires are a good way to diversify faculty. I mean, it is a challenge. I have felt this, you know, and heard this from students who have said, like, you know, I don't want to be, students of color who have said, you know, I don't want to be on all the recruiting material selling this false image of a diverse university. And, you know, the administrators at the university are thinking, well, we do want you on here because we want to diversify and you're going to help with that. I mean, it is a challenge to the location point. You know, I don't know what the demographics of Berea, Kentucky are, but, and that institution, as I mentioned, has a very unique history, but they have managed to, you know, they still have issues with the surrounding community and interactions with the students and the university folks, but they have managed to create a quite a diverse student, faculty, and staff population there. So it is limited and challenging based on where you are, the demographics of the community you're in. But, you know, the University of Michigan Flint is relatively racially diverse. And Flint is like 56% Black, and we have like 14% Black students. So we don't look like where we are. So we have a lot of work to do there as well. So that's where I think that, you know, the context is one thing, but also these institutions, how they operate and their practices, we really need to sort of dig into making some fundamental change and listening to people who are, you know, bringing up these issues, because it takes some level of love or hope or appreciation or commitment to an institution to bring up issues, because you want it to be better. You want it to do better. And so if we take those critiques in that way, then that can help. People can rightfully be really, really frustrated and have absolutely all the right to do that. And if that frustration comes out in criticism, it might hurt to hear, but it's actually coming from probably a good place of wanting the institution to do better. Someone says, what do you say to those who resist enrollment and retention goals for students of color, saying that we are trying to have quotas? So I would say, you know, we're in an interesting spot in Michigan. So what we are allowed to say is that we want to have a diverse student body and diversify the student body. And saying that, it's with the recognition that there are academic benefits to a diverse student body. If you have students that come from all sorts of backgrounds and experiences, different races, different nationalities, et cetera, in a classroom, the conversations that you have, the ideas that are generated, there's a ton of research on the benefits of that, right? So there is an academic case for that, that diversity benefits all students. The retention goals are not, I mean, so that's where, you know, no one's going to have quotas, because a quota is like a hard number figure. Having percentage goals, I think, makes sense. If you say, you know, wherever Manchester, the community, surrounding community, say it is 5% Black. So then you make a goal that the campus should have 5% Black students. If you're arguing against that goal, your argument is that other students are inherently better, because you're making an argument that somehow these other students are more talented and deserve the spots, right? I think that's an odd argument to make. And if you call it that way, it might make people uncomfortable. But you can think about, if you're a company and you're recruiting exclusively from Big Ten schools, that's not an equitable way to recruit, because Big Ten schools are not representative. If you begin recruiting from historically Black colleges and universities as well, that is more equitable, because talent is not, one group doesn't have a monopoly on talent, intelligence, et cetera. So when we look at Congress and I see overwhelmingly a bunch of very old white men, those cannot be the best leaders. Those cannot all be the best leaders. What are the odds of that, right? There should be some young women in the Senate. There should be we should see all sorts of different people in there, because the people who are most qualified to do those things are not all those folks. So, you know, for retention goals, I think the argument is easy. If some students are being retained at higher rates than others, then what are we doing, or what are we not doing for those other students, and how can we better support them? Because we want all students to graduate. And it is better for all students if everybody can persist and continue.
All right, so I am going to cut us off here. I thank you once again so much, Dr. Luke, for joining us remotely from Michigan. And thank you to all of you watching on Zoom or Facebook, and also for those of you who might be watching this recording. If you are a student, or I should say an undergrad student, and you want to get credit for this VIA for attending it, don't forget to take the quiz on Canvas, and have a wonderful night, and stay tuned for the next the upcoming VIAs that we have. All right, we'll see you later.
Thank you all.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Anne Gregory for providing the audio for this program. Our music is by Mark Waldeck, Noah Campodonico, Kurt Remke, and Hope Arthur. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Our production assistants are Alex Costanzo, Steve Mullaney, and Sydney Wagner. Until next time, thank you for listening. From WBOI Fort Wayne.